is Apologetics 15 and Lesson Number 2. And we're going to begin on page 11. This is the second section of the 2,000-year prophecy by Jesus. We have been discussing the desolation of Jerusalem that took place in A.D. 70 under the Roman general Titus. Now, Matthew 24:23 says, "Then," that is, while that's going on, "if someone might say to you," there's your personal pronoun coming in again, "Behold, the Messiah is here or here, might you not trust?" Mark 13:21, "And then if someone might say to you," there it is again, "Behold, the Messiah is here or behold there, might you not trust?" From the use of "then," toteth, you can see section 1, page 14, because I explained it back then. It seems that these warnings apply primarily to the period of the desolation of Jerusalem, and Josephus gives some specific examples. Now, the top of page 12, Matthew 24:24 says, "For false messiahs and false prophets will be raised, and they will give great signs and wonders so as to lead astray, if possible, even the chosen." Mark 13:22. "For false messiahs and false prophets will be raised." Identical, you see. "They will give signs and wonders towards the to be leading astray off, if possible, even the chosen." Matthew 24:25 continues, "Behold, I have said before and still say to you," says your personal pronoun, "if therefore they might say to you," there it is again, the people he's talking to, "Behold, he is in the wilderness, might you not go out?" And that's part of the verb, so you can't include that one. "Behold, in the store chambers, might you not trust?" And that "you" is part of the verb. But notice those in the boxes. Mark 13:23, "But you, yourselves be looking." Look at the emphasis. "Behold, I have said before and still say all things to you." Now, I think it's pretty clear that he's talking to the people, and he's warning the people there, not future people. Notice the personal pronoun. So exactly were these prophecies fulfilled and examples recorded that I cannot push them into the future. These are the only two uses of false messiahas in the New Testament. There could be no false messiahs after the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, I say that and wish you to weigh that carefully, because that's why you don't find the word used anymore. But you see, until it was Jerusalem to be delivered and to be saved from the invaders, there could be no false prophets, false messiahs. And they had to be Jews, and they had to be turning the people to God, quote, and turning them away from the attention to the Romans, and that God would give them the victory. And that's what these false messiahs did. So once Jerusalem fell, there could be no more false messiahs until some way future date. But he's saying to you, he's not talking about a way future date. I must show this one scripture and some examples in Josephus which fit these prophecies perfectly, which show that it happened. Here's Acts 5:36. "For before these days rose up Judas, boasting himself to be somebody, to whom a number of men, about 400, joined themselves, who were slain, and all as many as obeyed him were scattered and brought to naught." There they were. See, these people rising up. "After this man rose up Judas of Galilee in the days of the taxing, and drew away much people after him. He also perished, and all, even as many as obeyed him, were dispersed." Now notice how Josephus gives the record to show you these kind of things were going on. Now, that's Acts, and that's much earlier than the desolation of Jerusalem. So that was already coming to pass in fulfillment of the things that Jesus is talking about. So when you already have it coming to pass within Scripture itself, I think you take a very great risk trying to push it away in the future. Now, on top of that, you have Josephus. Look what he says. There was also another body of wicked men gotten together, not so impure in their actions, but more wicked in their intentions, who laid waste the happy state of the city, no less than did these murderers. These were such men as deceived and deluded the people, look, under pretense of divine inspiration. And that's exactly the kind of thing we are facing today in our day. But this is the problem. But we're for procuring innovations and multitudes who act like madmen. Procuring innovations and changes of the government, and these prevailed with the multitude to act like madmen, and went before them into the wilderness, as pretending that God would there show them the signals of liberty. Now, you notice what they said? Look back up above you at Matthew 24:25. I have said before and still say to you, if therefore they might say to you, behold, he is in the wilderness, might you not go out? And that's where they were taking the people. Exactly so, into the wilderness at the time of the siege of Jerusalem. But Felix thought this procedure was to be the beginning of a revolt. So he sent some horsemen and footmen, both armed, who destroyed a great number of them. But there was an Egyptian false prophet. There's another one. Excuse me. That did the Jews more mischief than the former. For he was a chief, and pretended to be a prophet also, and got together 30,000 men that were deluded by him. These he led round about from the wilderness, there we are, back in the wilderness, you see, to the mount which was called the Mount of Olives, and was ready to break into Jerusalem by force from that place. And if he could but once conquer the Roman garrison and the people, he intended to domineer over them by the assistance of those guards and of his that were to break into the city with him. But Felix prevented his attempt and met him with his Roman soldiers, while all the people assisted him in his attack upon them, insomuch that when it came to a battle, the Egyptian ran away with a few others, while the greatest part of those that were with him were either destroyed or taken alive. But the rest of the multitude were dispersed, everyone to their own homes, and there concealed themselves. So you have two instances of them leading them out into the wilderness, which is exactly what Jesus told them. Now, note this passage. Now the Romans, judging that it was in vain to spare what was round about the holy house, burnt all those places, as also the remains of the cloisters and the gates, to accept it, the one on the east side and the other on the south, both which, however, they burnt afterward. They also burnt down the treasury chambers. Hold your place. Go back to Matthew 24:25, the end of that verse. Might you not go out, behold, in the store chambers, might you not trust? The treasury chambers or the store chambers, whichever. And he said, they'll say they're there. In which was an immense quantity of money, and an immense number of garments and other precious goods. There's the store chambers. There be reposited. And to speak all in a few words, there it was that the entire riches of the Jews were heaped up together, while the rich people had there built themselves chambers to contain such furniture. Don't you see this is an exact fulfillment of Matthew 24:25? The soldiers also came. Now you see, you can't have this future until after a temple would be built again, at least. And so there isn't any temple now, so there's no way that prophecy can be filled. So what do? In the pre-trib viewpoint of Matthew 24:25, well, they simply say that verse means that you can't tell where he might be. That is not what the Word of God says. It says, some will say, behold, he's in the wilderness, and we've seen that. Behold, in store chambers, we're seeing that. Continue. The soldiers also came to the rest of the cloisters that were in the outer court of the temple, whither the women and children, a great mixed multitude of the people, fled in number, about 6,000. But before Caesar had determined anything about these people, or given the commanders any orders relating to them, the soldiers were in such a rage that they set the cloister on fire, by which means it came to pass that some of these were destroyed by throwing themselves down headlong, and some were burnt in the cloisters themselves. Nor did any one of them escape with his life. A false prophet was the occasion of these people's destruction, who had made a public proclamation in the city that very day, what? That God commanded them to get up upon the temple. See? God told me. There's that same idea. God told me. It was just as prevalent then as it is today. And that there they should receive miraculous signs of their deliverance. Now there was then a great number of false prophets governed by the tyrants to impose upon the people, who denounced this to them, that they should wait for deliverance from God. See, there you are. And this was in order to keep them from deserting, and that they might be buoyed up above fear and care by such hope. Now a man that is in adversity does easily comply with such promises. For when such a seducer makes him believe that he shall be delivered from those miseries which oppress him, then it is that the patient is full of hope of such deliverance. I'd like to take that last part that I have underlined there and apply it to those that are healers today, so-called. Quote, these seducers make these people think they can do these things, and people in such misery, they easily follow them. They easily let astray. Same thing applies today. But I want you to see that Josephus records the exact fulfillment of Matthew 24:25. Exact. Now, coming over to 13. Now consider Jesus' answer to the fourth question. This is up at the top of the page in the margin. What the sign of thy presence? Matthew is the only gospel where the word presence, parousia, occurs. Now, here it is, Matthew 24:27. For as altogether the beam of light is coming out from the sunrise, from sunrisings, and is appearing till sunsetting, thus also will be the presence of the Son of the Man. Now I want to comment on that later, but just let me pass that verse for right now. Verse 28, because that isn't reading exactly like you read it in your King James, anywhere near. Let's go to verse 28. For where in which the corpse might be, there the eagles will be gathered together. Now the corpse is understood by many to refer to Israel, and the eagles to the Roman army. Now let me show you that. And I've shown you standards, by the way, back on page 8. Here again, we go to Josephus. And now the Romans, upon the flight of the seditious into the city, and upon the burning of the holy house itself, and of all the buildings round about it, brought their ensigns, standards, to the temple, and set them over against the eastern gate, and there did they offer sacrifices to them. And there did they make Titus imperator with greatest acclamations of joy. Now, notice that this then is considered the abomination of the desolation, because idolatry is an abomination. I didn't have room to put all of that in, because I didn't want to get involved with the abomination of desolation, because these idols that Israel worshipped were called abominations. And so this is another case of this offering to idols. Since this verse occurs after the sign of his presence, it may well refer to the final gathering of the nations against Israel. In other words, since verse 28 comes after verse 27, it's possible that this verse does have a future signal to it in there. This would make the plural eagles more likely, that all the nations will be gathered. And that is a possibility that I would certainly have to leave open, suggest you put a question mark there. I would like to show one more passage where Titus acknowledged God. And I thought this was just so important that it ought to be in here. Now when Titus was come into this upper city, he admired not only some other places of strength in it, but particularly those strong towers which the tyrants, in their mad conduct, had relinquished. For when he saw their solid altitude, and the largeness of their several stones, and the exactness of their joints, as also how great was their breadth, and how extensive their length, he expressed himself after the manner following. And you remember, we started this whole history with a discussion of the stones. How in the world could beautiful stones, that stones of massive proportions, could ever be thrown down? And that's what Titus said. How could it happen? Watch what he says. We have certainly had God for our assistant in this war, and it was no other than God who ejected the Jews out of these fortifications. For what could the hands of men or any machines do towards overthrowing these towers? Look at that. Titus acknowledges that God had to give it to them. There was no way they could have captured Jerusalem and just thrown the tower down by their machinery, so-called, because their rock hurlers and battering rams would have made no impression on these stones. And that's why the very beginning of our subject looks so impossible to the disciples and to the others that were gathered with the Lord Jesus on the Mount of Olives. Just didn't look as though it could be done. All right, now, come to your margin again. Remember how these impressive stones made the overthrow of Jerusalem, and especially the temple, seem so impossible to the disciples. And I give it in the reference. You can go back to the other section. Now, coming to the top of page 14. I will reserve comment on Matthew 24:27 till later. I've asked you to just wait on that one a minute. Matthew 24, you'll see why. 29. But immediately after the tribulation of those days. Now notice that. There's nothing says that this is the great tribulation. Absolutely nothing. It says the tribulation of those days. And what he's talking about is the destruction of Jerusalem. Now if you change subjects on him, that's a different story. You're going to get the thing mixed up. The sun will be made dark, the moon will not give her radiance, and the stars will fall from the heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be stirred. Now, what do you do with this kind of a verse? Well, if you're a pre-tribber, well, you say, this is going to be heavenly disaster, stars are going to fall from heaven, and you go right along as though it could happen. Let's go further. Can it happen? Mark 13:24. But in those days, after that tribulation, see the point again? That tribulation, the sun will be made dark, and the moon will not give her radiance, and the stars of the heaven will be falling away, and the ones in the heavens will be stirred. All right, go a little further, Luke 21:25, and signs will be in sun and moon and stars, and over the earth a holding together of nations in perplexity, as sea and surface soundness. Verse 26. As men are stopping breathing from fear and anticipation of the things coming on for the inhabited earth, for the powers of the heavens will be stirred. And they all end up with that. The powers of the heavens will be stirred. Now, the major question at this point concerns the sun, moon, and stars. Are these verses figurative or literal? There are at least four good reasons why these verses are not literal, but figurative. Number one, a single star falling from heaven to the earth would wipe out the earth long before it could get here. The sun is 92,900,000 miles away with a central temperature of 40 million degrees centigrade. The nearest star is 25,500,000,000,000 miles away. Stars move from 10 to 100 miles a second. Now, taking the fastest star that we have so far measured, at 100 miles per second, not an hour, not a minute, a second, 100 miles per second, roughly goes 8,640,000 miles per day. And then what? It would take roughly 3 million years to get here. 3 million years to get here. So unless it has already started centuries and centuries ago, and we would have seen it getting larger, and we would have been obliterated already long ago. Because you see, the light from these stars, like Betelgeuse and Belichick, the light from these stars left it there, traveling 186,000 miles a second, when Jesus was born. And it's just now getting here. So you see what you're up against. You're up against the absolute physical impossibility in God's whole created universe. Now, if you took our atmosphere away, the sun will cook us in a matter of a few minutes anyway. There wouldn't be any earth left. There wouldn't be any earth to come to. Wouldn't be any state of Israel to set up. Wouldn't be any millennial reign. The Bible would be totally confused and, I'd say, just refuted. All right, let's go to point two. We'll be falling away. Now, there is that one. See, that's got a star marking it up above. We'll be falling away. No, not that they're going to all fall away in some future point, but they're going to be doing it over a progressive time, over a long period of time. It's a periphrastic future, like I've been explaining to you back on page four. The stars will be continuously falling away, not all at once, but in a stream, so to speak. Now, that's the second reason it can't happen. The first star got here, obliterated us long before it got here, and the rest wouldn't have any place to fall to. Three, God uses the permanency of the stars for Israel's guarantee of their existence. So God would be destroying his very witness to Israel. So Jeremiah 31, 35, you need to read it. Thus saith the Lord, which giveth the sun for a light by day, and the ordinances of the moon, not the moon itself, but the ordinances of the moon, the laws that keep them operating, and of the stars for a light by night. Now it isn't the light they give, it's the ordinances that control them, the whole zodiacal system that moves and gives a witness, which divideth the sea when the waves thereof roar, the Lord of hosts is his name. It's those ordinances that part from before me, saith the Lord. If the whole zodiac system departs, then the seed of Israel also shall cease from being a nation before me forever. And that's why Israel has the zodiac on their postage stamp. They say that it belongs to them. God gave it to them as proof of his steadiness for Israel. Thus saith the Lord, if heaven above can be measured, and the foundations of the earth stretched out beneath, and we haven't succeeded in measuring anything concerning the heavens above yet. Every place they try to measure, they find out there's more yet out beyond that. I will also cast off all the seed of Israel for all that they have done, saith the Lord. So all of this is God's guarantee to Israel. The zodiacal system belongs to them indeed. Now, the fourth point, so that's another reason. The fourth point, God uses these things figuratively. He does this right along. And I thought we'd better put a page in to show you this, because you won't understand if I don't. Back in Genesis 37, verse 9, and he dreamed yet another dream, and told it his brethren, and said, behold, I have dreamed a dream more. Now this is Joseph's dream. And behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren. And his father rebuked him and said unto him, what is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee, to the earth? Now we read that and we don't think. That's one of our biggest troubles, we never think. Shall I and thy mother and thy brother indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee, to the earth? Now, he's not asking a simple question. You have to read in there what he's saying. He's trying to alleviate this concern of the brothers. And he's saying, in effect, shall I, maybe me, yeah, possible, your mother, that's ridiculous, she's dead. And thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee to the earth? Now, brothers, he's in effect saying, now, brothers, don't get excited. How can his mother come and bow down to him? So forget it. Now, see, he's trying to get around it. Now, what's the side margin? From Joseph's dream, his father understood the sun, moon, and stars to indicate himself as the sun, Rachel as the moon, and the 11 stars as Joseph's brothers. Since Rachel was dead, how is this verse understood? Now look in the Jewish Midrash Rabbah and said unto him, what is this dream? And so forth. Rabbi Levi said, in the name of Rabbi Hama, then Rabbi Hanina, Jacob thought that resurrection would take place in his days. Hence he said, I and thy brethren shall indeed come. That may well be, but shall I and thy mother come? Rachel is dead, yet thou sayest, I and thy mother will come to bow down to thee. But our ancestor did not know that it applied to Bilhah, Rachel's handmaid, who had brought him, Joseph, up like a mother. Now that's a way around, you see. That's a way around, but notice the footnote that they put in the Midrash. Quoting the very next verse, which I didn't put in, it's Genesis 37:11. Next verse. Nevertheless, his father kept this thing in mind. Thus, he regarded it as possible, even in respect of Rachel. And this involved resurrection. When this dream was related as evidence for the future, though he had rebuked him, that was because he stirred up his brother's hate. But actually, he believed in the dream. Now, I thought that was very interesting to open up this side issue here so that you can see the sun and moon and stars represent Israel. And there's not any question about it at all, because we have it again in Revelation 12. There appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. Now, how in the world could this poor woman have 12 of these enormous stars sitting on her head? It's ridiculous. You don't take it literal there. Why does it have to be literal some other place? Why? Because if you don't take it literal in the other place, then it upsets you, and your whole plan falls apart. Let's go on. You'll see in a minute. And she, being with child, cried travailing at birth and pain to be delivered. And this is Israel, as you see from Genesis 37. This is the way it was understood. Now look at the use of stars like this in some other passages, Revelation 1:20. The mystery of the seven stars which thou sawest in my right hand, and the seven golden lampstands, better, the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands which thou sawest are the seven churches. So here you have seven stars that are angels. Now, you can see they're figurative, and you don't have any trouble with these figuratively. But you want to make that Matthew 24 passage that we've been looking at, you want to make that literal. And it isn't literal. It cannot be literal. Look at Jude. These are spots in your feet of charity. When they feast with you, feeding themselves without fear, clouds they are without water, carried about a wind, trees whose fruit withereth, without fruit, twice dead, plucked up by the roots. Raging waves of the sea, foaming out their own chain, wandering stars. Stars leading astray, more exactly. To whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. These persons are called stars. All right, look at Joel 2:9. They shall run to and fro in the city. They shall run upon the wall. They shall climb up upon the houses. They shall enter in at the windows like a thief. The earth shall quake before them. The heavens shall tremble. The sun and the moon shall be dark, and the stars shall withdraw their shining. You see, there they're just withdrawing their shining. They're not falling at all there. Joel 3:14. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of the season, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of the season. The sun and the moon shall be darkened, and the stars shall withdraw their shining. There you have it again. Look at Ezekiel 32:6. I will also water with thy blood the land wherein thou swimmest, even to the mountains, and the rivers shall be full of thee. Now, don't you see what he's saying, how these figurative passages are interlocking and the enigma, part of the enigma. And when I shall put thee out, I will cover the heaven and make the stars thereof dawn. I will cover the sun with a cloud. Now, you know that physically you can't cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon shall not give her light. Let me start there on the next slide.